Welcome to the Pain Gap Podcast. Join me as I engage with experts, patients, journalists, legislators, and policy experts. Together, we'll explore intersectional health disparities and advocate for accessible, equitable healthcare for women of all backgrounds. Let's ignite progress and demand urgent action for women's health worldwide. Yes. Well, I wanted to ask you because your book really made me realize, and first of all, it was so therapeutic for me to read, but it really made me realize that the search for identity and belonging kind of never ends. I mean, I was born and raised in Bangladesh, but I went to an American school there, and I haven't lived there since I was 18. And really in my 20s, I moved to Italy for a little bit, and I loved it because I spoke Italian, and people thought I was Italian. They never asked me where I was from. It was great. But your book made me realize that that quest kind of never ends. And I quickly want to read, that search never ends. And I quickly want to read such a beautiful passage from page 54. This, you talk about when you first went to boarding school in France, this feeling of otherness sank its claws right through my clothing and deep into me. Underneath what I wore, I resented my body. I didn't have the genetic skinniness of French girls my age. I didn't have the straight hair, the swagger, the sense of belonging. I didn't have grandparents who lived in some other part of the country or ancestors who had spoken the same language. There were no registries of birth in a village church for a great uncle I'd never met. I'm skipping ahead. Everything had to be explained. How do you say your name? What is Syria? Are you Arab? Why are you blonde? It must be cold in Siberia. I had parachuted into another world, a visitor in my own home. Does the search for belonging ever end, or is that an answer we're always looking for?
Well, I mean, for me, it was always going to be a lifelong quest because I'm born to Syrian parents in the U.S., raised partly in France, living now in London, married to a German. I mean, you couldn't possibly have more, you know, overlapping layers of identity. And it's not just that my parents come from one place and I was raised in another. They come from a completely different culture, a completely different part of the world, a different religion, and a religion that is in the news a lot and not always described in the most, you know, positive way. My whole life has been kind of a search for how to accept myself, how to love myself. And I think this is a universal search that people, especially children of immigrant parents, live almost on a daily basis, having to explain themselves, having to audition for sympathy, for this notion that I am just as valuable. Please accept me. You know, part of it too is your personality. I think some kids are just a little bit more self-confident. I was lacking in that confidence. Externally, it might not be that obvious, but internally, I was struggling sometimes. And I think writing this book was a good exercise because I realized in the end, you may not find the home you're looking for, but what you're looking for is in the journey. And I think that's the conclusion I came to.
Well, I love that because it kind of made me think about how I had this conversation with my daughter the other day because I thought that I had arrived at my identity. Okay. I was like, okay, well, I was born in Bangladesh, now I'm Bangladeshi American. I have sorted out. It took me 44 years. And then my daughter said to me the other day, which said to me, my husband and I, she was, you know, not behaving well. And so I said, hey, you know, watch your tone with us. You're not American. We're not American, is what I said to her. Right. And she said, but I am American. And you know what? She's right. She was born here. She's raised here. Washington is the only home she knows. She's 12 years old. And I was like, oh my goodness. And I had another identity crisis because I was like, oh, my children are American. They really are.
I do wonder when she grows up if she'll feel
how
this
she'll
way.
Feel.
I think at some point also you have this existential kind of question that, you know, when you become older, when you have children of your own, when you reach middle age, when suddenly, you know, you're having to kind of You have a more philosophical, sometimes even spiritual assessment of the life lived so far and who you are and where you come from may be a little bit more important, though your kids have never lived anywhere else. By the time I was 12, I had already lived in four countries and moved schools every 2 years. So possibly she has a firmer grounding.
Grounding.
And I think very important for children to have. I didn't necessarily have that as a kid.
Yeah, you know what? In a way, I was envious that she was able to have such a simple answer, I guess you could say. She's like, well, I know because my husband is Iranian-American. I wanted to ask you, I loved this part about your grandmother in the harem. I'm sure every interview is going to ask you about it. First of all, it needs to be a little movie. But you know what was so cool about you, that entire chapter, is that you put women in the forefront of this historical background. Like, I feel like women are, it's history books are just written from the perspective of men. So why did you include that part? So important. And why was that important to you to include in the book?
Well, it was important because it was a story of displacement, of forced migration. This is the story of so many women who lived in the Sultan's harem during the Ottoman Empire, because the Ottoman Empire really was this gigantic, sprawling empire that went all the way deep into the European continent. And in the case of one of my female ancestors, into Georgia, current day Georgia. And these women were either sold into slavery, brought to the palace by their family because they were going to be getting a great education and live as aristocrats, or kidnapped. And in the case of my ancestor, there was an abduction that took place when she was a child. And this story was passed down through oral history in my family, and I wanted to write about it because it must have also been a major crisis of identity for this woman who ended up as a child in the harem, this hierarchical, highly competitive dormitory for, confined women, and then who ended up married to a Syrian Arab and living then the rest of her life in Aleppo after the Ottoman Empire fell. I wanted to include that because this was the starting point of this very long story and tale and saga of displacement and search for a home.
Wow. I mean, it's incredible. And I feel like you did her such tribute by doing that, by including her story in there. So you're writing about the Arab Spring in the book really just broke my heart. Because you articulated so many things. It almost feels like, a bad dream. I was one of those people that was like, ready to run to Tahrir Square and join the fight for the revolution. But you mentioned something about on being there. And I want to read that passage because it's so important for journalists. And I love that you talk about it. That night, we were joined by CNN's Ben Wiedemann, and as we co-anchored the network's special coverage from the floor of the hotel room, sitting on a lighting box with curtains drawn behind us, I remember thinking it looked like a hostage video. I had been truly scared that day. At one point, I wondered if I would be physically hurt, but the elation of telling the story on air with arguably CNN's biggest star anchor made it all worth it. I was 40 years old, and I felt like every sacrifice I had made to get to that point in my career had been worth the struggle. I was there. Earlier in the chapter, you talk about the there. Talk to me more about the there.
This is what every journalist, I think, ultimately does this job for. I mean, if we're being really honest, it doesn't mean that good journalism doesn't happen in other ways. You can write a fabulous magazine profile, you can be a great analyst in a studio. But ultimately, I think the really memorable moments of a journalist's life are when they are touching, feeling, smelling the story, they're there. And the there is, your feet are on the ground, you're in the middle of the story, you're living it, you've got that kind of like front row seat. And you're able to experience the story in a kind of tangible way. You can touch it. And that is on steroids what happened in Tahrir Square, because I was witnessing finally a people saying to their leaders, I want dignity, I want freedom, this regime needs to go. This leader needs to step aside. I want elections. It wasn't just that. It was also the fact that, I was I was finally seeing the Arab world move in a direction I didn't think that I would ever witness firsthand. It was an unbelievable moment. And then it was also very dangerous. I mean, I had very in a very scary way a couple of times. And this was before, by the way, Lara Logan.
I was going to ask.
So that came after. I never would have gone to Tahrir Square by myself, just
you
walking
even around. Say in the chapter, you're like, I should have been safe, but the situation was completely different. I mean, you really got out of that crowd. I won't ruin it for the readers, because everybody really has to pick up this incredible book. But I mean, if it wasn't for that guy who you saw in the beginning, right?
But also importantly, it is all the reason every story I tell is somehow tied to identity, to who we are, how we present ourselves, what language we speak, how we are, what identity, what mask, or what drop, or when we decide to drop the mask, all of those things, how it plays into our reporting. In that case, I went into Tahrir Square and I immediately started speaking Arabic.
Yeah.
And my Arabic is not great. I mean, I'm missing vocabulary words, but the accent is very Syrian.
But also the Egyptian dialect, sorry to interrupt, it's different, right? It's a little bit different.
Accent, but people usually will understand Syrian Arabic because it's one of those accents that people will have heard on TV and in movies and things like that. Similarly, the Egyptian accent is usually quite well understood all of the region. And so I immediately started speaking Arabic and identified myself as a Syrian. And I thought, well, this is going to help me connect with people. And
one of them.
Yeah. This guy, when he came and saved me from that mob that I'm quite certain would have assaulted me that day, I think felt a connection with me. He felt like he, you know, wanted to help me out of a tough situation. And would he have done it had I not immediately established that kind of cultural, personal connection with him before entering the square? I'm not so sure.
Oh my goodness. Well, that was such an incredible part of the book, because I mean, that's exactly what I was thinking. I was like, oh my God, Lara Logan. And yes, so, and that was before, right? You're saying that your experience happened before her.
I had returned to the U.S. by the time what happened to Lara Logan happened, because it was on the night that I think Mubarak stepped down, and there was great elation in the square, but there were also these crowds. I mean, it was so dense, and there was, you know, there were many reports of women who had been groped and assaulted.
Yeah. And Egypt already has just very high, I think, like daily sexual harassment rates are really crazy in Egypt. I think it's something like 80% of women in Cairo have experienced sexual harassment. The permission to fit in. There are so many. It took me so almost a little bit longer to read your book, because I had to go back and reread so many beautiful passages that you had included. But I want to read from page 125. That's what all my post-its are. Marked these beautiful passages. So I know you talked about this at the Politics and Prose, and I know you've talked about this, and you changed your name and kind of, you know, taking part of in your own whitewashing. But on page 125, you say, on my resume, I had become a blonde American born French educated, fluent in French and English only, Hala Gharani. With a few weeks, I received double the number of callbacks. It had worked. I was being given permission to fit in. Tell me about that.
Yeah. I mean, now that and a lot of people have highlighted that section, interestingly, when I had just graduated from a pretty elite school in France, so you would think after that I wouldn't have that many issues getting interviews, at least. I mean, I'm not even talking about jobs here. So my friends and my fellow graduates were getting a lot more callbacks and interviews than I was. And I already had 2 years of freelance experience in journalism, and I was kind of puzzled. And then a friend from Sciences Po told me, you know, if you have Arabic written down as one of your languages spoken, I would just remove that. And by the way, there's a whole lot of evidence that Mays in France with Arabic sounding names get a lot less.
Oh, I'm sure. I've actually had someone say that to me recently about how, anyway, whatever, just anyhow, I've had to pay up my whole life. They're like, can we call you Anu? I'm like, no, that's not my name. And by the way, that's a whole other name. But I've always kind of, I don't know, reinserted it. But that was good advice that you got, sadly.
No, but in the U.S., you hear that with African-American, typically African-American sound names, and resumes are get less, you know, positive feedback and attention. And in France, the fact that I wrote that I spoke Arabic and that I was using my dad's last name, which was Basha, and I didn't have a picture. And so my friend said, just put a picture, you know, and remove the fact that you speak Arabic. And then I then unilaterally decided, well, let me just use my mother's name because it just it's just more generically European sounding. But, you know, it's actually really sad because speaking Arabic should be an asset and not a liability. Now, this is in the 90s. To be fair, I think things have changed quite a lot. But I was so desperate to not just to fit in, but also to work in journalism that I was willing to do pretty much anything to get my foot in the door.
Okay. The other thing I wanted to talk to you about was this beautiful line on page 131 when you say, this is something very, very interesting. France didn't want me, and so I would have to not want France. This was about like not having the right, you know, journalism degree, but you had the bachelor's in economics, you studied politics and science, political science. I want to talk to you about that because I was so obsessed, obviously, with identity and the role of British colonialism, obviously, and partition and everything in South Asia. And somebody told me something that really stuck with me, that the British were more racial about their colonization. And it was about, you know, skin color. It didn't matter how good your English was, at the end of the day, you'd never be as good as them because you were brown. But the French had a different approach. It was supposed to be, if you speak French, so it was about the language. If you speak French, you are French. But I feel like recently that has really been kind of like, no, it's very racial for the French as well. So what did that kind of, what do you think about that? And what did that feel to you? Were you being rejected by France?
Yeah, I really did feel that way. And I think in, generally speaking, in Western countries with increased migration and globalization, there's perhaps more of an, there can be a resistance to kind of accepting the notion that, you know, a nationality, a citizenship, a language is all you need to be considered fully a citizen, fully a member of that society, that there can be that resistance. And it's at 20-something, it is something that I experienced, that I didn't feel like I was considered fully French. Then later on, when I worked for CNN for 23 years, there was huge interest in me suddenly because I was an American journalist interested in French affairs. And then I was invited on all these talk shows and I was like treated with a lot of, you know, there was a lot of interest in what I had to say. But it was more because I was the American journalist covering them and there was kind of this desire to ask me what the world thought of France and things like that. So I don't think I ever really felt fully accepted as a equal. Not that I was considered less than, but I was considered different.
Yeah.
And not necessarily French in the way that they understood French to be, to what it meant for them.
So you think France now, especially with everything happening, with all the generations of young North Africans that have grown up in France that consider themselves French, do you think France is kind of having an identity crisis?
I think France is still trying to figure out what it is as a country that, including all of its citizens, including the citizens that are of Muslim and North African extraction, it is still trying to figure it out because it's a country that has build itself as this secular egalitarian republic. Mm-hmm. And so therefore it has rejected things like obvious cultural differences coming from its Arab and Muslim minority. And it is in fact legislated against headscarves in public places, and there have been kind of local bans on the burkini and stuff like that. So, and then there's also been the populist politicians in that country who have weaponized, in many cases, some of that identity crisis that the country has felt because of its lack of integration of some of its minority populations to, you know, whip up sort of a nationalist, sometimes nationalist anti-immigration sentiment. We're seeing it in other parts of Europe as well. So France is one of the countries in the West that is still grappling with how to navigate a globalized world where migration and immigration and minorities from non-European, non-Christian countries fit in to their national identity. And I think that country still has a long way to go.
What a great response. Thank you. Yes, a long way to go.
I hope that made sense.
No, that made so much sense. I wanted to ask you, because before I even messaged with you, or I wouldn't say know you, but before we had any kind of connection and the Syria war happened, I used to watch you report it and just think, oh my goodness, this woman's family is from there. Like, how is this? How is she so strong and professional? And wow, I guess if you're at that level in your career, you just have to kind of be superhuman. In the book you talk about, of course, that wasn't the case. But also, I mean, you talk about Haiti. You talk about covering, I mean, after that concert shooting in France, I want to say Baccarat, and where you say the dead are still warm, right?
Yep.
You're speaking in like hushed tones. Like, and then you say later that the human brain, you don't think the human brain is built to be able to absorb so much and see so much suffering and everything else. So tell me, because you say that at the end, it took a huge toll on your mental health.
Yeah, especially I think of the Syria war. I would watch almost every frame of video that came out of Syria in 2011, 12, and 13. And at one point, I really just couldn't watch a single frame anymore, or I thought I was going to just break down, because I was watching just people getting shot. And then I was watching the destruction of cities I loved. And I imagined.
We watched it in real time. So sorry to interrupt. And then had to report and explain it and anchor it to the world.
Yeah. And it was every day. You know, when you anchor, it's a lot more pressure than when you report. It's very difficult for people to understand that, because anchoring is 5 days a week, no matter what, whether you have a great breaking news story or you have nothing at all, you've got to be on air 1 hour a day.
Mm-hmm.
And for many years, the top story was either Trump or Syria.
Yeah.
And so
that's a double whammy for most people, right?
But during the Trump administration, it was also constantly interviewing, you know, people who were supporters of Donald Trump, and you would have to kind of push back against factually incorrect statements and the rest of it. And then I had Syria as well at the same time. And so those two things were a lot together. But before Trump was elected in 2016, there came a time when I couldn't watch any more Syria news. And even when it was on my own show, I would take my earpiece out because I couldn't hear the sounds of war or listen to the
crying,
of the reporter talking about the latest migratory wave or forced displacement or destruction or collapsed buildings or a baby getting pulled from the rubble, or I couldn't take it anymore. So I would tell the director in the control room, like, I'm taking my earpiece out for a second. Just let me know when the package is almost done so that I can put it back in and then start anchoring again. I didn't do that for very long. I did that for a few months just so that I would protect my mental health. But I didn't tell anyone at work.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't tell that I needed time off or anything.
Oh, no, of course not, right?
Yeah, of course not. But it was a lot, though. I really, and also this illustrates another important point. is that you don't just, I'm not saying this was PTSD, by the way, but you don't just get PTSD when you're there. You get it when you're exposed. And you can be exposed through video. And it's been proven people who take in raw feeds of conflict zones, even if they've never set foot there, can develop really bad PTSD from that.
Yes.
So people have to keep that in mind, that it's not heroic or brave to force yourself to watch violence. It doesn't mean you're weak if you're affected by it. It means you're human. And that's very important. And I always tell young people entering this business that it doesn't mean that somehow you're not strong enough to do this job if you don't feel like you can watch people get threaded, or those horrible ISIS videos, which I never, ever watched a single frame of, beheadings and things like that. It doesn't make you necessarily a strong person to get through that. And protect your mental health. Because once you are, I think, traumatized by something, the road back is really hard. And you have to be careful.
It's better to stop and kind of recognize this is so important, and so important to hear from you. And especially what you just said about you don't have to be a reporter to have this kind of PTSD or a journalist on the ground. I feel like what we're watching with the Gaza war on our phones is so, I mean, just talking as like a normal person, that I know that just me and some of my friends, that Palestinian woman and so many mothers across the world, when she was holding her, there's so many images now, but she was one of the early ones to come out of the war, and she was talking to her dead child. She was saying, whispering something to him. And, you know, obviously he's wrapped in a white cloth. And I just felt like I knew exactly what she was saying to her child who had just died. But it was one of the first times where I was like, I can't have this feed like on my phone and then go back to, I don't know, having happy hour with friends, or you even talk about it. You go and cover the Gaza war, and then you're back in London that night for dinner. So admitting it is actually the strength, saying you need help, because you're right, we're not designed to take
it. But I will say for women, it's always been trickier, because women are much more likely to be seen as weak and unable to cope than men.
Yes.
And I've known throughout my career women who've suffered from PTSD or who've been traumatized and were taken off air and then were not allowed back on air. Oh. Whereas men can just come back, you know, with raging PTSD symptoms, you know, substance abuse, you name it. Wow. And then it's like, weeks? Okay, you're good. You're going to go back.
You know, that's sad for the men too, because for so long they were not allowed to say, actually, I can't handle this. It's too much for me, right? So sometimes they actually have it worse when it comes to, I guess.
Yeah. But I feel like women were, now it's different, but were treated with kid gloves a lot more. So they,
yes, because they don't want a woman to break down, right? She couldn't handle it. It was too much.
And honestly, as you know, I mean, the women, there should not be any doubt in anyone's mind that women.
Seriously. Just,
and what's interesting too in the industry in the 25 years that I've worked in TV is that women are now just as much behind the scenes as they are in front of the camera, as producers, as camera women. And that is a very, very big departure from when I started out, all those years ago. Yeah. It used to be, had a few female reporters on camera. You had CNN, I was lucky. There were a bunch of camera women who were fabulous. But otherwise, it was pretty male dominated. That's completely changed.
Yeah, that is awesome. Gosh, so important. Well, now that you have written the book, Hala, it's my last question. What is your advice as a published author? What would your advice be to someone saying, how do you write a book, Hala? How did you do it?
You should know that writing a book, first of all, requires the thickest skin in the world, because no one cares about your feelings. When you write a book, right? You're no one, from your editors to the people who end up writing some nasty review, or you have to have thick skin, because it's not a news piece. You're putting yourself out there. You're talking about your You're talking about your identity crisis and your childhood. Just understand how hurt I was in that schoolyard when I was nine, you know, because people are, I just didn't feel the emotion in the writing.
She doesn't even look Arab. It's like that.
Yeah. So you're kind of like having to, TV is just, it's a love fest compared to writing a book. I mean, I never thought that it just, you know what it's like. Yeah, you have to. Sometimes you get rejected, but before you get an offer.
Yes, I know.
Rejection. No, but I got 36 rejections before I got my offer. And then even when you write the book, then it's the editor tells you they don't like this, they don't like that. And then it comes out and then you. So there's that. So that's what I would say is develop a thick skin. Secondly, treat writing as a factory job. In other words, you sit down, you clock in and you clock out. Whether you are inspired that day or not inspired that day, you just do it.
I would like to stop 1 second. Sorry to interrupt you, but that is so important. The discipline of writing, folks. It's a discipline. 1 hour a day, minimum. Yes.
I put in 4 hours a day, which is why.
Oh, yeah, I was writing like a maniac. I think I was in there 20 hours a day. I completely locked my family out.
But you have to treat it as a job. So it's not going to them. It's like doing these things that you don't feel always like doing. Some days you're inspired, other days you're not. Doesn't matter. You put in the same number of hours. And I was doing it 7 days a week, by the way. I did not give myself one day off. I mean, I had a few days off here and there because, you know, I had some day booked doing something else. But I
developed carpal tunnel or something from all the editing you had to do?
I do develop carpal tunnel from my phone, but not from typing on.
Oh, I thought you, I don't know if I imagined that you had to, by the time you were done with all your edits, you had like a carpal tunnel, but maybe I just imagined that. Maybe that was just.
I had carpal, well, the reason, I think you're referring to why I leave voice notes on WhatsApp.
Oh, maybe. The
reason I leave voice notes is because my thumb is hurt.
Yeah, and I know.
Auto drives me crazy. I can't.
Still hasn't accept the F word. It's still saying ducking for me. Can I get over it? It's not, I'm not trying to write ducking.
So how you overcome that is that you save in your phone the word ducking with an F. I'm not going to say. And then it will recognize the contact if you want to overcome that.
Okay,
so every word that you want to be able to type out without autocorrect, you save it as a contact in your phone, and then it'll intuitively go, think you're, anyway, referring.
Amazing. Doesn't it also kind of like make the contact, the name kind of highlight? So it'll be like ducking with an F and it'll even color up for you. Like a step four.
At ducking with a capital F.
That's ducking war. Sorry.
That's number two. If I can just go back. So the first one is about the skin, thick skin. The second one is the discipline of writing every day, a certain number of hours a day, or a word count, whatever you prefer. And the third one is realizing that when you put the final period on the first draft, that's when the work actually begins.
Oh, yeah. Great advice. It's not over.
I'm done. No, you're not. You're about 20% of the way done. And then now get ready for
the editing process
of editing. So you go through, my book went through 4 or 5 iterations and structures. It's nonlinear. It's not chronological. Love it or hate it. And some of the reviewers didn't like it. I'm so sorry. But we decided to do it by location rather than by timeline. Because otherwise, when we were doing it, when I was writing it in a chronological way, I realized it was starting to sound a little bit like one of those family sagas. And we're all interested in our own. But most people are not that interested, you know, in our aunts and uncles' family. So I had to make it, I had to structure it in a way that the themes were coming out a lot sooner about me, about what I was, about this search for identity and belonging. And also about my job as a journalist, because that too was, it was always against the backdrop of my journalism career. So I had to make sure that was at the forefront. You know, when I started reading the book, I noticed the kind of structure right away. It's very different. But can I tell you that I love it? I love it. Yeah. You have some short chapters, and otherwise you can get lost in it, right? So actually, I think you organized the book. Perfect. That was going to be my last question, but I have to quickly ask you one more thing. You think being a writer, you need a thicker skin than in TV? Because yes, there is a love fest and a lot, but also being a woman on TV, I mean, I can't imagine what it was like. I mean, yeah, you get a lot of compliments, but you get a lot of vitriol and crawling. And I mean, I had someone message me one time after I was on Morning Joe, my first time, such a big, you know, deal for any journalist. And somebody wrote to me, it was just like a couple of months after I'd given birth, but she said, you should be embarrassed that you went on air like that. You look fat, you look this. And it was from a woman, and it was so horrible. And, you know, usually you can like just ignore and dismiss, but I was like, wow, people really feel like they have a right to tell you when you're on TV, when you shouldn't be on TV because of your...
Yeah.
What was it like aging on air? You think the book editing process is tougher?
Yes. But I don't care what people think about my appearance, and I don't care whether or not they think I anchor well or whether or not my questions are the right questions. I do not care. But I do care what people say who've read my book about my memoir, because it is my life. These are my personal, you know, in some cases, secrets that I reveal about what's really going on inside of me that I
very intimate.
So that matters. And also, I'm a first-time author, whereas I've been a TV journalist for 25 years. And so therefore, I've developed a kind of confidence in my ability, whereas I don't have that confidence yet, or I don't have as much of it yet in the book writing world. So I think it's tougher to be, and also there's a lot more, how should I put this? There are a lot more books out there. You're competing with a lot more people.
Which,
it's not like, you know, I've got 172,000 people anchoring a show.
True. Very good points.
Right now. So there's that. There's also it's a very different world. It's a much bigger, more difficult world to compete in than in TV, where I felt like I feel like I have a strong footing in TV now. And I'm not saying I don't make mistakes and that what I do is...
But that's your profession. That's like your...
Yeah, I'm cool. I'm cool. You want to criticize...
You are cool, Ala. You really are.
When I criticize my TV appearance, that's totally your prerogative. I don't really care. It's how I approach.
But you know what else it is? I think it's because you're writing. It's like, hey, those are my words. It's hard to, you know, like now I'm like, okay, you know what? Everyone have their opinion, but it still cuts. It really does. Especially on Goodreads.
I'll tell you what, exactly. Another secret is, if you are an author, and a secret, I don't know, but another thing for people to know is, if you're an author, the author will read all the comments on Amazon and Goodreads. Like, every author has read every single review, right?
Yes.
You can read five. The 10th one is crap.
Yeah.
And I spend all evening dissecting the crap one.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, but then she said that it went yin yang. And it's
totally analyzed.
Read the 9 good ones. I'm like,
seriously.
It's our brain. We're trained to just
on the bad
and the negative. This would be a good exercise to try to just move past that and just kind of focus on the positive ones. Maybe, I don't know.
I mean, my goodness, ladies and gentlemen, Hala Gorani has the same issues as we do, the same insecurities and fears. But you know what? It's so amazing is that you did it. You put yourself out there. You didn't have to write this book. You could have just signed off from CNN that day and been like, toodles. But what I think is so inspiring about your work and your career is you're just like, I mean, onwards. And this book is, it couldn't have come out kind of in a perfect time. I wish I had had this book after 9/11. You know what I mean? Like for me, but now I'm like, I'm so glad that kind of this young generation of American Muslims have it, because I mean, you articulate so many things and identify so many things
that are universal that I would never think Hala Guarani too, you know? So
I think it's important too for young people to read someone's story who's a lot older with a lot more experience, who maybe outwardly they look at it and think, oh, this person's confident, and realize that it's okay to have these insecurities. It's what makes you human. It would be psychopathic to go through life never once thinking that you're not enough or that you've done enough or that your mistakes have defined you, you know. So for me, it's important also to tell people who are coming up now in this business in a very different world and an industry that's going through a major crisis, it's okay. It's okay to be vulnerable. It's okay to admit your vulnerability. And it's okay also to feel sometimes out of place. It's what makes us human. And when you're human and you are vulnerable, when you the people you cover, you empathize with their vulnerability. And I think what makes a good reporter, it's not just the craft, the skill, and the technique. It's the ability to feel someone's suffering and someone's vulnerability as well. And when you, so therefore, admitting your own fallibility is a way to connect with the people that you're covering. I've always considered that to be one of the most important skills of a journalist is to feel someone else's suffering, mm-hmm. and admitting your kind of, I think, your weaknesses is part of that, is kind of part of that exercise, that journalistic exercise as well, if that makes any sense.
That makes so much sense. I could talk to you forever because, I mean, this is like an education. Thank you so much, Hala Guarani. This incredible book is out. It's coming. It's out Hachette America, and then it's coming out internationally, right? Hachette UK?
March 14th.
And so where can our international viewers get it? Amazon is the best place, or?
Yeah, Amazon, or you can order it. So March 14th is the English language international release, and you can order it from a bookstore, from what I understand. I've even gotten messages from people who've ordered it from a bookstore in Beirut, Lebanon. So it is possible. It might take a little bit of time to get there if you're in Beirut,
Istanbul.
But if you're in Europe, I think it's going to be quite close to publication date on March 14th, and it comes out March 14th in the UK.
Fantastic. And then what about Audible? Is there going to be an Audible version of this book? And I only ask because I had no idea audiobooks were such a big deal, but people really do they have the audio option.
So I recorded the audio book version and it's out. So you should be able to,
Amazon then. Yeah.
Or Audible, I think.
Well, Audible is owned by Amazon, so yeah.
Oh, no, it's not Audible. In any case, it's available, but
yeah.
I thought that for some reason somebody couldn't buy it on Amazon and they had to go through maybe the Audible app. And in any case, it is downloadable. It's out there.
It's out there. Fantastic. Hala Guarani, thank you so much.
Okay.
My very, very first guest on the brand new The Pain Gap podcast. Thank you so much for your time, and I will speak to you soon.